So anyway, we'll go ahead and get into the subject for this evening, and the subject is the book of Amos. And so Amos is a fairly long book, and for that reason, we're going to do that in two parts. So we'll do the first part of it tonight. I'm not sure when I'll do the second part. I'm thinking about the timing when we will do that, and I was uncertain whether I would do the second part right away, but I think I should, since you don't let too much time lag between studies that relate to each other. So I may, we'll see how that works out, but we'll look forward to the opportunity of sharing the second part of this with you. So anyway, we're going to begin the study here with a question. And the question is this, and it's a rhetorical question. You don't have to answer. And the question is, when was Hosea written? As you look at the minor prophets, for some of them, we can figure out the answer because of things that are mentioned in the book. Usually you'll find that the prophet was commissioned to relay God's word to the nation at and it mentions that he did his ministry took place during the reign of certain kings, and you get some hints about when it was written at the beginning of the book of Hosea, and that's good for some of them, others not so much. Six of the minor prophets tell us in the first verse when the book was written, and that's only a portion of them. The others don't give us that information. For instance, you have Hosea chapter 1, verse 1, and it says, "The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah." Now, this is a fairly extensive period of time, and so you can look at those kings, and you can see when they reigned, and therefore make a determination of when Hosea prophesied. You also get the king Jeroboam II, the son of Joash, who was the king of Israel, and he reigned during all of those, the time of those individuals. So you have one king of Israel and several kings of Judah, and they help us to determine the dating of when the book was written. The word of the Lord came to Hosea in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, as I said, the king of Israel. And as you look at those kings, there, it's a little bit hard to determine exactly when the reign of Uzziah began and the reign of Hezekiah ended, but we can get some ballpark figures to determine the dates. It's a little bit imprecise. It's not like we know today that when the presidents reigned and when they were in power, we pretty well got that nailed down. But at that time, it wasn't quite as specific. As you look at Hosea's ministry, it was to the nation of Israel, and Hosea was from Judah, and he was from a town called Tekoa. So if you look at the pictures that the maps I've given you, Tekoa was a city in the desert. So as it's the first one, and a city in the desert, you had Jerusalem further north that was had more rainfall and more vegetation, and Tekoa was more out in the desert, the wilderness of Judea. And it was a dry place there, and that's where Hosea was from. And as you look at Hosea, he was a Jew from, as I said, from the desert area south of Jerusalem. When Hosea carried out his commission, as I said, we have the kings that are mentioned there, and it gives us some inkling of when he prophesied. And based on the information given, we can figure out who was younger, Hosea or Amos. And based on the kings that we find in Hosea and Amos, we have the ability to deduce who was younger and who was older. And as I said, we mentioned Hosea 1:1, and Amos reads in a similar way. It says the words of Amos, who was among the sheep herders of Tekoa, that's where he was from, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, 2 years before the earthquake. And what earthquake? I'm not sure, but it must have been significant for it to be noted in the scriptures. As you look at Amos, he was sent to the nation of Israel, and Jeroboam II was the ruler at that time. He's an interesting character, and we will read more, look at him more closely as we go through the study. So So as we look at the time setting for Isaiah and look at that, it tells us some information about where all this fits together. In Isaiah chapter 1, verse 1, it speaks of a man by the name of Amos, A-M-O-Z, Amos, and that is not Amos, a different person, different spelling. And so Amos and Amos are different individuals. There's no confusion in the area of Isaiah not being the son of the prophet Amos. He's not the prophet Amos's son. They're two very different people. So Amos is a shortened form of Amaziah. And hold on just a moment. My wife's calling me here. There's confusion about the mention of Hosea. And both of these prophets prophesied fairly close together. And as you can see by Hosea chapter 1, verse 1, and Amos chapter 1, verse 1, that there is some intermingling between the two of them. So that's why I mentioned Hosea. This study, for the most part, is not about Hosea, but both of them are in the picture. So I just thought I would give you that clarification. In terms of Isaiah, as you look at age-wise, it's felt that Amos was the earliest of the prophets. He started prophesying earlier than Hosea, and so that's just something that seems to we can derive from the mention of the different kings. In our study on Hosea, we took a look at Israel in the days of Ahab, and we spent the first two studies in Hosea looking at the part of that Jehu played in bringing Ahab's dynasty to an end. That's an important part of what was taking place then. And so that all takes place, and we've moved on in time, and you'll understand why it's important to take note of that as we go through the information here. We looked at the former prophets being First and Second Kings, and looking at those First and Second Kings and Chronicles. Those books help us to understand about the history of Israel, which all fits in with the prophets. So these writers that we're discussing are writing in the context of what is laid out in the book of Kings and Chronicles. And they're writing in a time where everybody knew what went on in those times of the Kings and Chronicles. It's just like if people in our time mention Washington and Jefferson and Lincoln, we have an idea who those people are. We have some historical context that allows us to be able to understand who they were and what went on in their time. And the same was true in Judah and Israel. They knew something about their history, and therefore understood some things about what was going on in their time. Now, as we look at this, and we go back to Hosea, two promises were made in Hosea that shaped the four decades that follow the death of Ahab, and those promises are important to what we're going to discuss this evening. These two promises and their fulfillment actually set the stage for the book of Amos. And to understand the book of Amos, it helps to understand the promises that were made, that were fulfilled, and that set the stage for Amos. So tonight, we're not going to do a whole lot in the book of Amos. We will look at some background, and in the next study, we'll spend all of our time in the book of Amos and cover it in one study. So as I said, we're not going to do a lot in the book of Amos tonight. We're going to look at more background. To understand, we're seeking to understand why Amos is saying what he's saying. We're seeking to who he's saying it to and what relationship they had to what we've covered already in the book of Hosea. So we're, the hope is that all of us can understand what is going on here. So anyway, as we move on here, let's go to 2 Kings chapter 10. You don't have to turn there. I'll basically lay out what we want to note from 2 Kings 10. In that chapter, if you remember, Elijah was sitting and in a cave and wanting the world to come to an end. He's in a cave in the wilderness, and he lamented that things were so bad. They were seeking to kill him. Jezebel had put a bounty out on him, I'm sure, and was seeking to kill him. He was on the run and fearful for his life. And, he ended up out in the desert and didn't want to go on. And then he ends up in a cave, and God talks to him there in the cave. He just wanted to go into that cave and die. But God said to him, I've got things for you to do. So it's not your time to die. You're not going to be killed. I'm with you. I'm watching over you. And I've got things for you to do. So God told Elijah that he wanted him to go back north and anoint a man by the name of Jehu, who was a soldier in the army of Ahab. We looked at him before, and we're going to touch on him just a little bit here. In 2 Kings chapter 10, when Jehu was told his commission, the scripture tells us that Jehu carried out his commission to the letter. So as you go back in time to King Saul, Saul was given the commission to destroy the Amalekites. And when God said destroy, he wanted them to destroy Amalek completely because of the terrible things that Amalek had done to the nation of Israel. But Saul chose not to do that. So he did not destroy Amalek completely as God had wanted him to do. He spared the king of Amalek. He spared all of the good things that they thought they should keep. And he didn't do what God told him to do. And God was very unhappy with him. And that was basically the end of the road for Saul. God told him, you're not going to carry on. You'll carry on as king, but you're not going to have a dynasty that goes on for very long. And so God basically said, I'm done with you. And eventually somebody else is going to be given the kingship. And we know David was the one who took that position as time goes along. In 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 30, we see it said that because you have done well in completing your commission in letter and intent, then I'm going to give you a dynasty. In fact, you're going to reign, and there will be four other kings from your house that will reign. So you and four of your descendants will reign on the throne of Israel. So you will all reign. You'll all be kings over the nation of Israel. God was going to bless him and his house in that particular way. And as you think about Israel, that's no small promise that there would be one dynasty that would carry on for that long a period of time for five kings, because that was not the way things went in Israel. Israel as a nation had nine dynasties, and the turnovers in kingship were rather high. Some didn't last even a month. And one of the things that God points out to the people of Israel, he said, you're establishing kings, but they're not people that I wanted to be king. You've chosen them. You've murdered the former king, or you've established your own kings, and they weren't close to God at all and had no interest in what God wanted. They did what they wanted, which was displeasing to God. But God was going to bless the house of Jehu, and his sons and grandsons were going to reign in the kingdom of Israel. And that was a big deal. In fact, as you look at the entirety of the time of Israel, Jehu and his descendants ruled for a third of the history of Israel. And that's an amazing feat in the nation of Israel. But God blessed him because he did do what he told him to do. So God was very kind to Jehu, but it's interesting as you look at what Jehu did. Jehu did carried out his commission, but when it came to honoring God and ridding the land of the idols and rejecting the pattern of worship set up by Jeroboam, he didn't do that. He left the calves in Dan and in down closer to Jerusalem, and he did not destroy all of those things which God wanted him to do. So he got part of it right, but the cleansing of the land and eliminating the idolatry, he didn't do a very good job on. So as you look at the dynasty of Jehu, you have Jehu reigning for 28 years. And as you look through the sheets that I gave you, you've got one of those sheets that list all the kings. And I think that gives you some idea about how this all went. The dynasty that followed Jehu, and it gives you a listing of the kings, Jehu and his those who reigned after him. Jehu reigned 28 years. Jehoahaz reigned 17 years. Jehoash reigned 16 years, and Jeroboam the second reigned 42 years, a very long reign. And then the last ruler of the dynasty was Zechariah, and he reigned for 6 months. So I thought I would give you just a listing of the kings, the time in which they reigned, and the scriptures that relate to that. So these kings were kings that it's interesting, as we'll get into this, about these kings, and some of them had some great trials, others of them were very prosperous. The second thing that God gave to Elijah, and the second promise that went along with it, God wanted Elijah to go up to Syria and anoint a man by the name of Hazael. Now, that doesn't seem important. I mean, here Elijah is going to this pagan king, and he wants him to be anointed, and you think, well, what's that all about? Well, we'll see, because Hazael plays a very important role in the what takes place during Jehu's time and the time of those who followed after him as kings. The accompanying promise and what Jehu doesn't care about, getting rid of the idolatry, he says that what Jehu doesn't complete, you know, what he doesn't take care of, Hazael is going to finish it. So God was going to use Hazael as his instrument to accomplish his purpose. So Jehu got rid of the descendants of Ahab. He got rid of the prophets of Baal, and helped to clean that particular aspect of Israel out, but he didn't go far enough in God's sight. So in 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 15, 1 Kings chapter 19, verse 15, this talks about Elijah going up to Syria, to Damascus, and anointing a new king there. In verse 15, it says, "Then the Lord said to him, 'Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive, anoint Hazael as king over Judah, over Syria.'" Also, you shall anoint Jehu, the son of Nimshi, as king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint as prophet in your place. So Elisha's taking over for Elijah. It shall be that whoever escapes the sword of Hazael, Jehu will kill. And whoever escapes the sword of Jehu, Elisha shall kill. Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. So we see these three individuals who are going to house clean, Hazael, Jehu, and Elijah. And we can say that Hazael wreaked havoc with Israel. That's just a reality, as we'll see as we look at it more closely in the scriptures. So he wreaked havoc in Israel. He made life unbearably miserable for the northern kingdom. And he did so beginning in the time of Ahab and continuing on in Jehu's time and on down later as Jehu's sons came to the throne. And I'm giving you these details because this is the stage setter for Amos. Amos is told to write what he writes in a historic context. And so we look to Hazael, and we can see that what led up to what Amos wrote under God's inspiration. And understanding just how far Hazael went in humbling Israel is an aid to understanding the book of Amos. As you go back in the history of the United States, just as an example, you go back to the Great Depression. I wasn't alive in the time of the Great Depression. I was born in 1951, so the Great Depression had taken place in the late 1920s and 30s, so I missed that. But I knew about the Depression because my grandparents told me about the difficult times in which they lived. The Great Depression had a great impact upon the people living in America in the late 20s and 30s as the stock market crashed, and life was just plain tough. And it was hard to come by various food items and various, you know, clothing and other things. Life was hard for people then. So they were lucky to put food on the table. They were lucky to be clothed. They were able to do that, but it wasn't easy. They had to work very hard for what they got. I think my dad said that when he was growing up in that time that he picked blueberries or blackberries all day long and they got 50 cents. So I couldn't imagine being out there in the snakes and all the things in the blueberries and that's all you got. But that was a lot back then. And so America was impacted by the Great Depression. And then on the heels of the Great Depression came World War II. And that wasn't easy either. It was a time when there was rationing for you to get get gas or you to get a tires or something. You had to have coupons. And you only got so many coupons. And once you used them up, they were gone. So you had to choose carefully how you would use them. And then after World War II, you had the Vietnam War, you had the Civil Rights Movement, and going on down to closer to our time, 9/11, 2001. Those were all momentous events in the history of our country that we would all remember. And the mood of the nation, as Amos wrote, was the product of the events that had gone before. So as you look at Amos, you have to take into account what went before, because that helps you to understand why Amos is writing in the way that he's writing. So let's go to 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 7. 2 Kings chapter 8, verse 7. And in that verse it says, then Elisha went to Damascus, and Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, was sick. So Elisha went up to to Damascus, and it's amazing. Here is a prophet of God going up to this pagan king, and he's involved in their business. And he comes up to Damascus, and the king at that time was Ben-Hadad, and he was not healthy. And it was told him, saying, the man of God has come here. So Ben-Hadad knew who Elisha was, and knew that he was a prophet of God. He wasn't a prophet in Syria, but he knew of him, even in Syria. And the king said to Hazael, take a present in your hand and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord by him, saying, shall I recover from this disease? So he's sick. He wants to know if he's going to get well. And Elisha is able to answer in the affirmative. He is going to get well. And Hazael is the one that sent out to him to inquire whether he's going to get well. And he went out to meet the prophet Elisha and took him a present and brought him a present of every good thing of Damascus, 40 camel loads. And he came and stood before him and said, your son, Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you saying, shall I recover from this disease? So he wanted to know, am I going to make it? And Elisha said to him, go and say to him, you will certainly recover. Good news. You know, the prophet of God sees that you're going to recover. And he tells this to Hazael. But Elisha has more information because he can see the bigger picture. And he goes on to say, however, the Lord has shown me that he will die. He will really die. Yes, he's going to recover from his sickness. But even though he recovers from his sickness and gets well, his life is going to come to an end. And verse 11, then he set his countenance in a stare until he was ashamed, and the man of God wept. So Elisha is staring at Hazael, and he could somehow foresee what was coming when Hazael became king. He could see that Hazael was going to kill Ben-Hadad, and that when Hazael became king, it was going to be bad for Israel. He could see it, and he saw the terrible things that were coming, and it caused him to weep. He saw the terrible things that Hazael would do. The prophet goes on and says, because I know the evil that you will do to the children of Israel, their strongholds you will set on fire, their young men you will kill with the sword, and you will dash their children and rip open their women with child. So Hazael said, but what is your servant, a dog, that you should do this gross thing? And Elisha answered, the Lord has shown me that you will become king over Syria. So Elisha knew that he was going to be the next king. And as I said, when he became king, he was going to wreak havoc on the people of Israel. Going on in verse 14, it says, then he departed from Elisha and came to his master, who said to him, what did Elisha say to you? And he answered, he told me, you would surely recover. But it happened on the next day. So he tells Ben-Hadad that he's going to recover. But on the next day, he took a thick cloth, dipped it in water, and spread it over his face so that he died, and Hazael reigned in his place. So Hazael assumed the throne through treachery, and he was a treacherous, evil king from that time forward. So there was nothing good going to come in Israel as a result of his assuming the throne. So in 2 Kings chapter 10, I read to you earlier about Jehu, and let's read in that same area because it gives you a running start to in the book of Amos. We read where God blessed Jehu with a dynasty because of his diligence in carrying out his commission. So let's go to 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 31. 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 31. And this is speaking about Jehu, and it says, but Jehu took no heed to walk in the law of the Lord God of Israel with all his heart. And that's, you know, he was so diligent in wiping out Ahab's descendants, so diligent in clearing the land of the prophets of Baal, but he could have gone all the way, and he did not feel it necessary for some reason to do that. It says, for he did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, who had made the made Israel sin. Jeroboam had wanted to preserve his kingship. He didn't want any threat to it. And by allowing people to go down to worship at the temple, to worship God, to keep the feast at the temple, he felt that was unacceptable and was going to undermine his kingship if he didn't shut that down. So he does. He sets up his own idols and sets up his own priesthood and establishes his own religion. And as a result of that, he's able to better control the people in his land. 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 32 continues the story by saying, in those days, and second, let's pick up the story in 2 Kings chapter 10, verse 32. It says, in those days, the Lord began to cut off parts of Israel, and Hazael conquered them in all the territory of Israel. From the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh, from Aroer, which is by the river Arnon, including Gilead and Bashan. So if you look at your map that I gave you, it gives you a map. It's kind of got a gray section that says Bashan, and then down at the bottom is a dark area that would be the area where was Ammon and the territory of Israel went all the way down to the bottom of that map, which is the city of Aroer, and the river Arnon runs at the bottom of that darker area. So this area from Bashan going from the north all the way down to the middle of the Dead Sea was a very extensive area. It was the area of Gilead, and you had, and Gilead was a territory that was given to the three tribes, Gad, Reuben, and Manasseh, and it was given to them before Israel had crossed the Jordan. And what had happened as they came up to the land, they found that they looked at the land, and the tribes of Gad and Reuben and the half-tribe of Manasseh noticed that the land was perfect for cattle grazing. And so they were people who that was their business, was cattle, and they saw that the land was perfect for grazing cattle, and so they asked if they could have that land. So they were given that land, which ran all the way up to the base of Mount Hermon, all the way down to the middle of the Dead Sea. So it was an extensive area, and it was perfect for their type of agriculture. And so it was given to them, and it was a perfect cattle ranching area. And so you can see the names of these places, and you know that this is all east of the Jordan River. The Jordan River runs between the Sea of Galilee, which is about a third of the way down on your map, and all the way down, runs all the way down to the Dead Sea. So north of Gilead, you had the, from the Yarmouk River all the way up to Mount Hermon is the area of Bashan. So Mount Hermon is a mountain in Syria up here at the top of the area designated as Bashan. So what 2 Kings is saying is that Jehu and his dynasty did not give heed to God. And God let Israel loose, or Hazael loose. So have at it. And so he did have at it, and he wreaked havoc upon the nation of Israel. The first thing that Hazael did was strip Israel of every one of its possessions east of the Jordan River. And he didn't just conquer them, he slaughtered the people and wreaked great destruction on that part of the land. He conquered and subjugated all of it, and that's a massive chunk of the whole of Israel. And so you have this diminished territory, and so you have the agricultural aspect of it that no longer belongs to Israel. But that's only part of the picture. One of the things that you have to keep in mind is that you have trade going between Egypt and the area over by Babylon. So there's trade going on through this area all the time, and it comes through Israel. So if you take this territory from Israel, and there was another way to carry out the trade, which would be west of the Jordan, but there was a lot of trade that went north and south, east of the Jordan, and they didn't control it. So who did? Well, Hazael controlled it. So all of that trade contributed to Syria becoming wealthy. And when Israel controlled the trade routes, they became wealthy. And you'll see as we go through this that this is going to change as they get their territory back eventually as time goes on. But for a couple of kings, it's not going to be a good time for Israel. So let's go to 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 17. And so in relation to what I'm going to talk about here, you've got a couple of other maps that would be helpful to you. And it's this one here that has the kingdom of Israel under David and Solomon, and that there pertains to what it will pick, we'll see in 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 17. Let's begin in 2 Kings chapter 12, verse 17. There it says, Hazael, king of Syria, went up to and fought against Gath and took it. Then Hazael set his face to go up to Jerusalem. So if you look at your map, either one of these maps, you can see Gath. I think this one here is the better one. You can see where Gath is, and Gath is a place where the famous giant Goliath was from, and he came from that town, and that town is east of is west of Jerusalem, and you have Hebron and Beersheba and those, and you have Shechem and Megiddo. You have all of these places here east of or west of Jerusalem, and he came all the way down west of Jerusalem, and he conquered that territory, and he defeated they took over Gath, and as a result of that, Hazael set his face to go up to Jerusalem. In verse 18, it says, and Jehoash, king of Judah, took all the sacred things that his fathers, Jehoshaphat and Jehoram and Ahaziah, kings of Judah, had dedicated, and his own sacred things, and all the gold found in the treasuries in the house of the Lord and in the king's house, and sent them to Hazael, king of Syria. Then he went away from Jerusalem. So basically, he paid him off. So the king of Judah paid him off, and to keep him from conquering Jerusalem, so he turned away from Jerusalem and went back north. It cost them a lot of the wealth of the nation of Judah in order to escape from the wrath of Hazael. So carrying on in 2 Kings chapter 13. 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 1. There it says, in the 23rd year of Joash, the son of Ahaziah, king of Judah, Jehoahaz, the son of Jehu, became king over Israel in Samaria. And Samaria was the capital of Israel, and he became the king and began to rule there. And it says, and he reigned 17 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, and followed the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who made Israel sin. He did not depart from them. In verse 3, then the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel, and he delivered them into the hand of Hazael, king of Syria, and into the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, all their days, and all the days of those kings they were tormented by the kings of Syria. So they were not living the way God wanted them to live. And as a result of the sinfulness that was found in among the people of Israel, then God did allow them to suffer at the hands of Hazael and Ben-Hadad. And it was a very bad time for Israel. 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 4. There it says, "So Jehoahaz pleaded with the Lord, and the Lord listened to him, for he saw the oppression of Israel because of the king of Syria, because the king of Syria oppressed them. Then the Lord gave Israel a deliverer, so that they escaped from under the hand of the Syrians, and the children of Israel dwelt in their tents as before. Nevertheless, they did not depart from the sins of the house of Jeroboam, who had made Israel sin, but walked in them, and the wooden image also remained in Samaria. For he left of the army of Jehoahaz only 50 horsemen." So this is the nation of Judah. The Syrians only left them 50 horsemen, 10 chariots, and 10,000 foot soldiers. So for the king of Syria had destroyed them and made them like the dust at threshing. So as you look at Israel and Judah, they were more than capable of fielding a million man army. They could field that many men in warfare. And unfortunately, they were defeated, and Hazael just wreaked destruction on them. And so there wasn't much left of their army once Hazael was done with them. Hazael, in fact, destroyed Israel. 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 10. 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 10. There it says, "In the 37th year of Joash, king of Judah, Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, became king over Israel in Samaria and reigned 16 years." So there's a change in kings. And it's kind of confusing here because the names are similar, Joash and Jehoash. There and kings that have similar names in Israel and Judah. So there, you've got to carefully look at them and think about who he's speaking at to keep them straight. So, but Jehoahaz became king over Israel in Samaria and reigned 16 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord and did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam. So unfortunately, he was king in Israel, and God allowed him to be king as promised to Jehu. And but he did not turn from the pagan the worship that had been established by Jeroboam. Verse 12. "Now the rest of the acts of Jehoash, all that he did, and his might with which he fought against Amaziah, king of Judah, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the Kings? So Jehoash rested with his fathers. Then Jeroboam sat on his throne." And don't become confused here. Jeroboam, one, was the king over Israel when they left. They rebelled against the descendants of David's house. They left the kingdom and separated from it and set up their own kingdom. That was Jeroboam the first, and the Jeroboam we're talking about at this time is Jeroboam the second, and he reigned for a very, very long time, as you can see from the chart that I gave you. It says Jehoash was buried in Samaria with the kings of Israel. And verse 14 says, "Elisha had become sick with the illness of which he would die. Then Joash, the king of Israel, came down to him and wept over his face and said, 'Oh, my father, the chariots of Israel and their horsemen.' And Elisha said to him, 'Take a bow and some arrows.' So he took himself a bow and some arrows. And he said to the king of Israel, 'Put your hand on the bow.' So he put his hand on it, and Elisha put his hands on the king's hands. Then he said, 'Open the east window.' And he opened it. Then Elisha said, 'Shoot.' And he shot. And he said, 'The arrow of the Lord's deliverance and the arrow of deliverance from Syria, for you must strike the Syrians at Aphek till you have destroyed them.' Then he said, 'Take the arrows.' So he took them. And he said to the king of Israel, 'Strike the ground.' So he struck three times and stopped. And the man of God was angry with him and said, 'You should have struck five or six times Then you would have struck Syria till you had destroyed it. But now you will strike Syria only three times, and you won't destroy it. And eventually, because you don't destroy it, it's going to come back to haunt you. So as Elisha is dying, he gave an almost deathbed proclamation to let the king of Israel know that the persecution of Israel by the Syrians was coming to an end. So in 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 22, speaks about the fulfillment of the prophecy. 2 Kings chapter 13, beginning in verse 22. There it says, then Hazael, king of Syria, oppressed Israel all the days of Jehoahaz. But the Lord was gracious to them, had compassion on them, and regarded them because of his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and would not destroy them or cast them from his presence. Now Hazael, king of Syria, died. Then Ben-Hadad, his son, reigned in his place, and Jehoash, the son of Jehoahaz, captured from the hand of Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities which he had taken out of the hand of Jehoahaz, his father, by war. Three times Joash defeated him and recaptured the cities of Israel. So Hazael's oppression had come to an end, and Ahab's descendants had been wiped out. A new dynasty had been set up, and finally, there's a breakthrough here as far as the prosperity of the people of Israel. When you go back to what I talked about earlier, the Great Depression in the United States in 1929, everything was down, it was depressed, and life was hard at that time. World War II was hard, and as the war came to an end, even as the war came to an end, the nation did not spring back right away, but the way was set for it. And then in the 1950s, the nation really took off and began to prosper financially. So, and this was what took place in Israel after the defeat of the Syrians, the conquest of Syria and the defeat of their armies. Then things began to prosper for Israel once again. In 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 1, we see there's a significant turnaround. 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 1. There it says, in the second year of Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, king of Israel, Amaziah, the son of Joash, king of Judah, became king. So you've got the king of Israel, Joash, and you have the king of Judah, Amaziah. And so Israel is beginning to prosper. Israel is beginning to rebuild from its low point. And as you look at the troops that they had, they didn't have very many because they'd been wiped out by Hazael. So they're beginning to prosper again. But something interesting takes place here in 2 Kings chapter 14. Amaziah decides that he's going to go, he defeats the Edomites in battle. And from that defeat, he basically concludes that he's on a roll and that he can begin to reconquer Judean territory and that he can take back the land of Israel and bring it back and join it with Judah. And this king, Amaziah, sends out messengers to the king of Israel and said, hey, let's go to battle. He says, come, let us face one another in battle. And so the king of Israel says, yeah, you're getting a little ahead of yourself here. And maybe a little inflated in your opinion of yourself. And just because you defeated with your 10,000 soldiers, the Edomites, realistic. You're not going to defeat the people of Israel. You don't have what it takes to do that. And unfortunately, he decided that he would still go into battle with the king of Israel and the troops of Judah were defeated, and basically ran all the way back to Judean territory. So they were soundly defeated. And what happened was that the people of the army of Israel came down to Jerusalem. They captured the city and basically broke down the wall of the city from a certain point in the wall down to another point in the wall, about 600 feet worth, and left it wide open. And so if they got too big for their britches again, they would come back and just the wall would be already broken down, and they would punish the people of Judah. So anyway, Israel came against Judah, and in 2 Kings chapter 14, verse 14, it says he took, and this is from the contemporary English version, it says he took the gold and silver, as well as everything of value from the Lord's temple and the king's treasury. So this had already happened with Haziel. Now you have the king of Israel coming down there and taking all of the things from the temple and the king's treasury, and he took hostages, then returned to Samaria. So he took a big chunk of the wealth of the king of Judah in defeating them at that time. So after being crushed and held down by Haziel and Syria, Israel has bounced back in fairly short order and gained back all their territory. Basically, they retook the territory that they had once had under their control in David's time, and controlled it, got the land back, and took it all the way up to the bottom of Mount Hermon. So they had a great deal of territory once again. So you're looking at this territory that goes all the way north to Mount Hermon, and it says that they conquered a place called Hamath. And as you look on this map, it says Hamat, H-A-M-A-T, which would be north of up toward the Euphrates River. And so they've taken back this territory that was the ultimate extent of the territory in the time of David. So basically they've regained everything that they had lost. And because they had regained all of this, then all of the trade routes were controlled by Israel. And as a result of controlling those trade routes and all of the enemies that had been out there taking them on, they had all been crushed and defeated. And Israel basically was the big power in the area at that point in time. I mean, as you go back again to the history of the United States after World War II, who was the powerful nation that would oppose the United States? There wasn't one. So the United States was prospering, they were thriving, and the powerful nations, China wasn't a power, Japan had been defeated, Germany had been defeated, and Russia was just trying to get back on its feet. So there were no powers in the world to take on America at the time. And the same was true in this time, as they've defeated the Syrians, other nations, the Babylonians weren't a threat. The Assyrians were just trying to survive. They were in a war for their preservation against the kingdom of that was north and east of them. I forget what it's called now, but it's up what we would call Russia today. And they were able to defeat them. And they were fighting for their lives, so they couldn't be involved in fighting Israel. Same thing with Egypt. Egypt wasn't a power at that time either. So the nation of Israel, even though they weren't following God the way they should have, they were beginning to prosper. And so it was a time of great wealth, a time of great prosperity, and a time in which Israel thrived. And so that's this thriving nation is the nation to whom Amos was sent. And I think that we might compare it from our own context to the time of the 1990s here in the United States. So the 1990s was a prosperous time, and it was a time that, in certain ways, you could count as similar to Israel after the defeat of all of the surrounding powers, and Israel was basically the big dog and able to thrive. I'll read a couple of comments to you in closing, and this will set the stage for the next Bible study. In the Interpreter's Bible Commentary, it makes the following short comment. In the Northern Kingdom, the long reign of Jeroboam II saw a revival that brought a great measure of prosperity than had been since the disruption. That would be the separation of the two nations after Solomon's reign. The Northern Kingdom and the Southern Kingdom split, and they were not powerful from that time forward until this time when there's a revival in Israel. The International Standard Bible Encyclopedia makes a longer statement, and I think this encapsulates everything. Jeroboam came into power on the crest of the wave of prosperity, following the crushing of the supremacy of Damascus by his father. By his great victory at Aphek, followed by others, Joash had regained the territory lost by Israel in the reign of Jehu and Jehoahaz, and this satisfied Joash, for his death prevented further hostilities. Jeroboam, however, then a young man, resolved on a war of retaliation on Damascus and on further conquest, and the condition of the Eastern world favored his projects. You know, when we look at the Bible, Israel between David and the end of his reign had days of glory. And the big threats were the Egyptians to the south, the Assyrians up to the northeast, and even later, after the fall of Assyria, you had the Babylonian Empire. And during this time in which Jeroboam II came to power was a power vacuum, and they looked around and there was no one to give them problems. And so they were able to be the dominant power and to be able to rise and prosper. And unfortunately, on one level, that's good. But what happens to people when they prosper? Unfortunately, people, when they prosper and have little adversity, they don't do very well. Pride goes before the fall. And Israel, unfortunately, was prospering, and they were not a moral people. And so God sends Amos to them to correct them, to point them back to the right path and to do the right things. And God's goal was for them not only to prosper physically and wealth-wise, but to prosper spiritually. And Amos was sent in order to guide and direct them in that more positive path. So Israel was rich, powerful, safe, and in that environment, Amos comes on the scene and speaks to them about their internal problems. So in the next study, we're going to look at Israel's internal problems, and so we'll see what those problems are. And interestingly, I think as you look at those problems, you'll see that some of the problems we have in our own nation right now are problems that were found in Israel at the time. So that concludes the study for this evening. I hope you've found it profitable. It's an interesting subject. I'm sorry that people were confused about the mention of Hosea, but the two, Hosea and Amos, basically dovetail, and there are things in common with them. And so that's why I was mentioning them, and hopefully if it wasn't too confusing. So anyway, thank you for listening, and please have a great remainder of the evening, and we'll look forward to seeing you on the Sabbath.